within, and the pickings, to be frank, are quite slim. From 1957 to 1976, China was rocked by devastating political campaigns. We have the Anti-Rightist Campaign, the Great Leap Forward, the Socialist Education Campaign, and the Cultural Revolution. None of these offers a satisfying or credible pedigree for Xi Jinping's current program of socialist rule of law with Chinese characteristics. And so the early 1950s has to carry that burden on its own. The problem is that the arguments raised by Yang Jialong and others, and the searing backlash against them, subvert this possibility by exposing the gravity of the legal system's congenital defects and the ferocity of the controversies that seized it in its early history. And more damning still, they bear witness to where the nation's revered founders actually stood. And in this, they deny the legal system the origin myth that it craves today. Here we have the decision on socialist rule of law with Chinese characteristics, which was released in 2014, that kind of guides the censors. And here's an official study guide that the PRC, that the top-level political legal commission has commissioned to describe what the official orthodox interpretation of rule of law is. And it omits this entire history, and so the censors have to go forward on that basis. Now, it falls to the censors to resolve such nettlesome inconsistencies, and they have been busy. I took a look not just at the two law journals that I've spoken to you today, which are the ones that I analyzed principally to sort of prove the case, but at a number of other law journals and social science journals from both the 1950s and the 1970s. And if you look at particularly fraught periods in history, the anti-rightist campaign and the period around 1978 and 79, when legal ideology was still being hammered out after the Cultural Revolution, you will find in these journals an astonishing 46.4% of the articles missing, which is jarring when you think about it. Given the breadth of the CCP's insecurities, arguably no historical topic or period is safe from such manipulation. Moreover, the complicity of the database providers in hosting the sanitized content raises very grave doubts about their good faith. They're violating the trust of their users everywhere. They're contaminating our research when we use their holdings. And worst of all, by tendentiously distorting China's consciousness of its own past, they're distorting its possible futures and prejudicing them. So it's worth noting that the computational techniques I employed are double-edged weapons. They can also be repurposed to automate and enhance the work of the censors. Simply by manipulating any of the 30,000 plus parameters in my data set, an enterprising censor who really wants to be a defensive, a real activist, can fabricate bespoke versions of the historical record, each exquisitely tuned to the ideological and political requirements of the moment. It's a very short hop indeed from the algorithms that already filter and sort our news feeds, when we get on Facebook and other sources, to the nightmare of Orwell's memory hole, where reality is continually reinvented by the powerful at will. And if there's one takeaway from this talk, it should be that we must not suppose that these dangers are limited to China. They are, in fact, illustrative of the broader ramifications of our deepening digital dependence and the redistribution of power that that entails. As knowledge transcends its traditional corporeal vessels, it is slipping from our grasp, and ever more under the control of those able to enclose, harness, and commodify it anew. In myriad ways, this places us at their mercy, reliant on their stewardship, and more vulnerable than ever to the political, ideological, commercial, regulatory, and licensing terms that may impinge on it. Seduced by the digital dream, we actually hasten our submission when we purge from our shelves the physical evidence necessary to independently monitor the performance of these providers and hold them to account. The conditions for agitation, censorship, propaganda, and disinformation to flourish could scarcely be more favorable. So what do we do about it? Well, one thing I did is I used an online form on one of these databases to report, hey, you have some missing articles. Here are the names of the missing articles from such and such issue this year. And I did that for about five of them, just to see what would happen. And so I got form letter emails, basically, which said, so sorry, we couldn't find article number X, but thanks for your inquiry. It's missing. And so I thought, okay, well, at least these guys are on notice that we know that it's missing. But obviously, I have no market power as an individual consumer. Who am I, right? So one possibility, then, is to republish the censored content. Here are the tables of contents from 13 of the issues in the 63 articles that I'm just talking about in this sample from these journals of just these 3 years. So, you know, we could liberate the content, right? That's what we should do. Well, unfortunately not, because remarkably, our own intellectual property law prevents us from doing that. It aggravates the predicament. In the US, these Chinese law journals will be under copyright for 95 years until 95 years after their original date of publication, or until the 2050s at least. And so that essentially precludes republishing the censored content in print or online without the consent of the Chinese rights holders. And the Chinese rights holders want this material to disappear, so they're not going to grant their consent. This also affects, for example, the famous movie from 1988, which is now banned in the PRC, River Elegy, which made a big splash in the pre-Tiananmen period. You cannot buy a DVD copy. I've spoken to the filmmakers who would love to reissue it in critical edition, but they can't, because intellectual property law prevents them from doing that, because the Chinese rights holders want this to disappear. And so simply by digitally consolidating sources onto servers under its control, a savvy authoritarian government can lawfully project its domestic censorship regime abroad. The better to mislead foreign observers, advance its policy agenda, and shape the public opinion battlefield globally. They're using our institutions, our law, against us. And so, there's the copyrights. The digital turn is undoubtedly here to stay. If we're to prevent the practices described to you today from proliferating, then we have to confront them head on. Less growing distrust about the knowledge that we consume and produce metastasize. We've all heard about fake news. Well, we have fake history here. A subscription to an online database like this can cost a research university tens of thousands of dollars a year, and they have every interest in getting what they are paying for. And so collective action by a group of them to raise awareness of what is happening and also to demand redress from the vendors is certainly a necessary first step. But collaborative ventures to conserve legacy media, especially paper media, and to reinvest in the institutions that preserve it is also essential. And beyond that, knowledge creators, rights holders, content providers, and the institutions that subscribe to their products must also design and implement a series of industry-wide best practices. We need to do this collaboratively to uphold the integrity of our digital collections. We need to transparently log omissions and modifications, and we need to defend against tampering at the level of not only the individual character, but also the document and corpus. Such standards must apply not only to the digitization of legacy analog sources, paper volumes, but also to the growing quantity of sources that are now born digital. So what lessons should we draw from this? I would argue that the Orwellian possibilities of the digital turn are already here, and we need to wake up and recognize them. That's corrosive to scholarship, trust, and knowledge. It contaminates everything it touches. And that should be a wake-up call to knowledge consumers and producers. And in response to that, we need to adapt our professional training and our research practices. This gets to the basic epistemology of what we as scholars do, but not just the scholarly community, but what we as informed consumers of knowledge and participants in society must do as citizens. Context remains king. Also, traditional research practices remain king. If you're reliant only on these digital databases, they're wonderfully convenient, and they're seductive in that way. But as I've tried to show you, they're incomplete, and not just randomly incomplete. There's an agenda behind them. So we also need to preserve the paper record and defend our libraries and demand validated digital content. That means trusted providers who can demonstrate that they've digitized these sources in a way that's authentic, and they've also got a back end that's incorporated the technical safeguards to ensure that it remains that way. We need to engineer such technical safeguards into our knowledge infrastructure and back them up with mutually reinforcing statements of principles, not just from individual scholars, but from our professional societies, the American Historical Association, the APSA, to stand up for what they truly believe in. And beyond that, we need to have firm contractual obligations from our publishers so that they can't do what Cambridge University Press did, making articles disappear without anyone noticing to placate or be complicit in the work of the Chinese censors. It's understandable why they would do that. China's an enormous market for them. So they're doing it on commercial grounds. Tying their hands with contractual commitments would be a useful way. These dangers are real. Never before has knowledge been prone to such supple and sweeping manipulation. History depends on us doing something about it. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Yes, sir. Leo Bosner, I'm a researcher with the Global Taiwan Institute. Can you tell me how far have they been able to penetrate into Taiwan, or has there been resistance there on changing the records?
You know, that's something I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
And so, when you say penetrate, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, for example, that English university and the German one, they were willing to change their stuff. It seems like China would really be trying to do that in Taiwan. But also, when I've been over there, they got a pretty strong spirit against that. So I was wondering if you've heard anything on that.
Well, historically, publishing an academic work in Taiwan has also been subject to its own domestic political pressures. But so I would not be able to comment on the extent to which China is able to sort of shape the discourse and control publishing in Taiwan. But it's probably something that should be looked at if it hasn't been already.
And one other quick question. You mentioned some of these journals in the Western world that have censored stuff.
Yeah.
What about making a list of those online to let the researchers know, hey, the following sources have censored out their stuff from China? Because I know when I look online for English language stuff, there's certain things I don't even bother reading.
Yeah. I think that's useful because to call out the names of who is complicit in censorship is important. But even so, Springer said, so what? You know, we have a business case for censoring. And we don't want to lose the Chinese market. So that was not persuasive, but it's still a valuable tool.
Yeah, they lose me.
Glenn, if it's all right, could I collect a couple of questions since we're
absolutely
a little bit short on time? And thank you very much, sir, for introducing yourself. If you could just say your name and if you have an affiliation. So why don't I try and take three questions? I'll start with you, Bob.
I don't know if it's a question, it's just a comment, because the way you presented it, it's as if Cambridge is removing information from a global database. But I mean, that is just very much of a domestic issue in China, isn't it?
Yeah, right. So it was
the question would be, how is this that different than a generation ago when Western publishers, hard copy publishers, were seeking to get access and negotiating the same way, trying to get their books into China, and confronting the same thing that this book you can't publish, this book you can't.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about the history of the printed censorship post 1980?
Well, right. So the print, as I say, you know, censorship in the PRC is something that we're all used to, and we know that they manipulate and have manipulated the past before. I think what has changed is this is English language or Western language sources that they're now censoring, and in particular, they're doing it without the consent of the authors, who suddenly discover that things that they wrote have been disappeared from the record without anyone asking. And those authors are understandably very upset. Many of them are quite prominent figures in the Chinese studies community. But beyond that, I think the larger issue and what has changed is that this can happen behind the scenes in a way that's truly dynamic on a day-to-day basis. Potentially, if the censors wake up in a bad mood one morning, they can implement their will instantaneously, and it propagates around the world very quickly. No questions asked. They don't even have to leave their desks. So that's the new paradigm we're in that I want to call our attention to. And it's also true what's changed is China now has market power that it never had before, and it's not afraid to use it. And so we need to sort of, you know, be aware of that the game has changed.
Thank you. My name is Tang Biao, NYU. So the Chinese Communist Party manipulates history not only in China and online, but also influence overseas. For example, the textbook and teachers, some of these teachers hired by the Confucius Institute, moreover, I sent my children to weekend Chinese school, and the teachers there were fed with this fake history. So they were brainwashed, and they are teaching the next generation this kind of fake history. So, yeah, what's your opinion on it?
Yeah, I think that there's certainly potential for that. It depends from location to location, and I've heard that from a great many people. What I think is interesting about this is that China is, in this way, by manipulating the databases, able to change the sources that foreign scholars have access to. And so in that way, they're able to get foreigners to kind of do their bidding for them, simply by presenting a sanitized version of the historical record. And unless you have the old school research tools and your library happens to be one of the few in the United States that has the paper, you would never know that this stuff had ever existed in the first place. And your idea of what happened in the legal system of the 1950s would be rather skewed. Right. And then the English language literature that flows from that would be skewed. And the way we teach it to our students would be skewed. And to the extent that we participate in policy making, that would be skewed.
Your emphasis is on the foreign effect. My personal view is this is pretty much 90% directed internally in China. When they talk about China's great soft power, they're really telling the Chinese people how great they are. Is there any debate about this stuff in China? I mean, from one point of view, this is traditional, going back at least to the Qianlong Emperor. They've used great collectania to sanitize stuff. They're not unique in the world doing this. But is there any debate within China, or is the CCP saying, hey, this is traditional Chinese culture to censor stuff, we're just a traditional Chinese state? I mean, is there any debate? Because if it is 90% domestically, for domestic consumption, and it's just done, and there's no backlash to it, then, you know, it's bad that foreign scholars have to be careful, but if you have careful scholars enough time, I guess they can figure out better than perhaps people in China what happened and what history is. So basically, that's the question, if there's any discussion of this in China and how deep it is.
I think you're right that to a large extent, foreign scholars are collateral damage in this, and that it's directed primarily to a domestic Chinese-speaking audience. Chinese scholars are absolutely aware of this, though. I presented it to Chinese scholars, and it was eye-opening for them to see it presented and analyzed systematically. But they know it exists, and it's also the environment that they're forced to operate in. And so they do complain about it privately, but they also can't change it. Now, what's interesting is that these vendors provide a sort of universal interface. It doesn't matter whether you're in the country or not. I've had the experience of using the People's Daily database, full-text database, at two different universities. And those universities signed contracts with two different vendors. One vendor has its servers hosted in the PRC. Another vendor doesn't. You search exactly the same terms in those databases and you will get different results. And you need to be aware of that. And sometimes certain terms will actually lock up the search engine and you'll be frozen out for about 2 or 3 minutes. And they're the usual ones that we can imagine. So that means that the People's Daily database has a foreign version, which is fuller and more complete, and then a domestic version, which isn't. These databases, which the academic journal databases, don't operate that way. China is exporting its domestic censorship. And so the vendor, the university that subscribes to the narrower version of the People's Daily, is waiting for their contract to expire so that they can do something about it.
You know, when I go to the grocery store, they have labels on things that say non-GMO product or something like that. Why don't you simply copyright a term the research bases would have to use to say not stored in the PRC?
I think that would be hard to do, though, because of copyright.
Label. Okay, our database is hereby certified by Professor Tiffert's organization that we do not store information in the PRC. It's not censored. Like the non-GMO labels on milk.
That's one possibility, and I think, as I said, we need to collaborate. The institutions that actually write the checks and buy these products are the ones who can actually force change. And so one of the things that I'm doing at Hoover is to try to pull together a common effort to ensure that that's done. Yeah.
If I can use my prerogative as chair, one observation and one question. So I think in my own work, your bit about China not being the only one to do this. I work on South Asia. The Human Terrain System is a program that the American government came up with to fight the war on terror and was extremely controversial about recruiting social scientists. Because the controversy, if you try and look it up now, it's gone. It's just been totally erased by the US military. There's a placeholder and you can't find it anymore. Of course, some academics working on it, you know, got the web page saved on that, but still, it just kind of reminded me of that. My question is, as a historian and a historian of the 19th century, because what it seems like you're really talking about is the construction of an archive. And I wonder if what you're dealing with is misaligned expectations, in the sense that if you talk to a historian that deals with not the modern age, we expect the archive, number one, to be constructed, and number two, incomplete. Where it seems like, especially what you're talking about here, with the kind of panoptical archive that it can be constructed, that can include anything, and then you can digitize and you can search, that maybe what's being run into here is the manipulation of the archive and an older story that has new contours of commercialization and the power of technology that the state is wielding towards it. So I just wonder if you might comment on that.
Yeah, I think that generally the way we're schooled and the way we train our students is to assume that archives are constructed, and to assume also, and to look at the historical record that they present as a verisimilitude, not as a complete capture of reality. However, I think we need to go beyond that, because what this shows us is that that reconstruction of reality is dynamic. There's the tendency in traditional scholarship to assume that the archive that we find is in a way a stable kind of bequest. It was constructed in its own day, and maybe there were wars or fires that shaped it in some way or another, but we go there today and it's not going to be different next week. This, however, presents that possibility in a way that we have yet to come to terms with the implications of. And so how do we adapt to that new environment? That's the question. And part of it is commercial, it could be ideological. And you're right, it's not just the program you were speaking about. There are also NGOs that are devoted to scraping pages of EPA data before they are disappeared too. And so it's like, it is a larger problem. That's right. Digital is evanescent.
All right, unless there are any more questions, then please assist me in thanking Professor Tiffert for a wonderful